This is an ABC podcast.
Ni san bolivinaka, aloha kakao, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Hopefully you've had a great weekend, so thank you very much for joining us today. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and up on today's show, today marks 25 years since one of the worst coups in Fiji. We've got the latest on cover smuggling in the Northern Territory, and shortly we'll hear from a political expert on why Samoa may go into an early snap election. Those stories and more coming up on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with a Pacific community leader in Australia who fought for the resumption of commercial guava imports. Fears they could be stopped again now that guava smuggling into the Northern Territory, where it's banned, has also resumed. Last week, ABC News broke the story that the illicit guava trade to remote Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory is back in full swing since commercial imports resumed a few years ago. That was a major reason why imports were banned nearly two decades ago, and Pacific Islanders in Australia are worried history could repeat itself. But a guava grower in Vanuatu doesn't think that will happen because of the economic and political importance of the trade to Pacific Island countries. Liam Fox reports.
Ratu Masinawa, a leader in Brisbane's Fijian community, is among the Australians of Pacific Islands heritage who lobbied hard to get commercial kava imports flowing again. He was devastated when he saw the news that smuggling into the Northern Territory has also resumed.
It's just disappointing that people went back the same way. And, you know, if the government turns around and bans kava again, it's just, I just don't have any good things to say about those people.
The Australian government banned imports back in 2007, in large part because of the harm that kava smuggled into the Northern Territory and sold for exorbitant prices was causing in remote Aboriginal communities. After that, the only way you could bring kava into the country was on a flight from a Pacific country with a 2 kilogram limit for personal use. That meant it was hard for Pacific Islanders living here to access kava for cultural and social use. So when the government announced in 2019 that restrictions would be eased and commercial imports resume, it was warmly welcomed. Now, though, Ratu Masinawa is worried that could all be undone.
After all the things that we did as a community, especially for our Fijian community, like we had to go through a whole lot of video interviews and radio interviews with you. We were able to go use our senators, Senator Paul Scar, to lodge our proposal in Parliament, in the Senate.
Michael Luthay from the Vanuatu Kava Industry Association had mixed emotions when he saw the ABC story about kava smuggling into the NT.
I was not sure if I was to laugh or to cry because of it. You know, like they were presenting the kava seized as if it was a big shipment of cocaine or heroin or some really dangerous stuff.
But he doesn't think there's a risk the kava trade will be shut down.
Because I will hope that if something like this happened and they try to ban kava, I will hope that the governments in the South Pacific will react strongly and will just say, no, this is not acceptable. This is normal trade. This is a normal product. This is far less dangerous than alcohol. So if you want to ban it, we will not accept it. And we will expel your high commissioners. We will retaliate by banning import from Australia.
Another reason Mr. Luthay doesn't think Australia will stop kava imports is the political nature of the trade. A big part of the reason why then-Prime Minister Scott Morrison decided to ease kava restrictions was to strengthen relations with Pacific countries to counter China's growing influence in the region.
I think Australian government realised the importance of kava, not only from a traditional and cultural perspective, but also economically. And also they must realise that it's not some fentanyl sort of thing. No one is overdosing from kava here.
He thinks the answer to the problem caused by smuggling into the Northern Territory is simple. Lift the ban there.
By legalizing it, you're just getting rid of all those would-be rich, quick guy who will be smuggling kava in some remote communities. You just have kava available in the shop, kava bottles available, maybe just with a normal dosage sort of thing. You could have some kava bars opening and people would be quietly drinking kava in a quiet and safe environment.
Ratu Masinawa doesn't agree.
I don't think we should do that. I mean, in my opinion, I think there's a reason for doing that in the NT. That's why they do that. They ban kava because they misuse it over there.
He says it's common knowledge Pacific Islanders are involved in the smuggling and their communities need to take action.
Get the community leaders to be, up in arms against these people who are doing it because it's spoiling the whole Pacific Island community. And it's just so unfair.
And that's Ratu Masenawa from Brisbane's Fijian community, ending that report from Liam Fox. Now, after surviving two recent attempts to remove her from office, Samoa's Prime Minister Fiamea Naomi Mataafa is facing mounting pressure to call an early election. In an unusual twist, those calls are coming from two men who rarely agree on anything. Opposition leader Tuila Epasailele Maalia Lengaoi and Lauli Leautia Schmidt, the chairman of Fiamea's Fast Party and a former cabinet minister. The next election is due around April next year, but the calls for an early poll follows months of political turmoil, beginning in January when the PM sacked Lauli, who's facing criminal charges, and he in turn removed her from the Fast Party. Confused? Well, our Samoa reporter Adele Fruin spoke with political expert Salah Dr. George Carter for his analysis.
This ongoing discontentment between the two leaders, although it may seem like a long time spat, it's also important to note that they were once of the one political party, the Human Rights Protection Party, with also the forefather of Lauli being a founder and leader of HRPP. But of course, where we are at the moment in terms of two leaders don't see eye to eye, but this time, seeing that maybe it's time for Fiamea to step down, this is where they've converged. And I think this is coming from a point of anxiety for both leaders, but also people within the two parties of FAST, those who are following Lauli, and of course the Human Rights Protection Party. The longer the current Fiamea government continues to be in government, they also have the luxury of time to build alliances, not only amongst existing 15 members of those who have allegiance to Fiamea, but also in terms of new people who may want to run for elections, new candidates, especially those who see the values and the leadership that Fiamea brings. It comes from that anxiety that as Fiamea builds her party or builds a party, we're waiting to see what that will be. And that could be a formidable force in elections. And we have seen that in the 2021 elections, that it may not necessarily be the FAST factor, but rather the Fiamea factor that pulled the country together to support the party, the Red Party, that was FAST.
Now, since she was kicked out of the FAST Party, Prime Minister Fiamea Naomi Mataafa now only has the support of around 15 MPs, including herself. Yet there are 53 members of parliament. Can she even remain prime minister with the minority government, or should she call an early election? What do you think?
Definitely. Not only history in other governments, but stability in other Westminster systems where there is a minority parliament, as we saw in New Zealand in recent past, that you can rule or you can carry out the functions of a government as a minority. If you have support of maybe independents or maybe they come through smaller parties. Now, we do not have that in Samoa. However, I don't think we see that the timeline finishes in April 2026. We may not see any big legislation that needs to be passed from now until then. Sort of the big tasks or the promises that the FAST Party, those legislations have been undertaken, especially with the land legislation. So that's been taken care of. And the option here is it's at the discretion of the Prime Minister. And in this case, it's Fiamea. Now, I think calling a snap election, as I said, will disadvantage her in terms of building a formidable new party or new team or inviting members of the current HRPP or inviting members of the current FAST to join this new group. It will be a disadvantage to call for a snap election. So I don't foresee that. I do foresee that Fiamea will continue to call and on social media, but also in various instances has called that she wants to bring stability and ensure that this term completes the current, whatever name we want to call it, Via May Fast, or we will definitely see, I think, many more opportunities led by either Lauli or Tulepa to try and make sure that they force, if it's not FMA, but it can be through the courts to call for a snap election.
The current state Samoa's in, you know, would Samoa be ready for an early election?
So there is quite a lot of work that needs to be done for a registration. And so we're unsure whether where that mark is now. But part of that is to make sure that there are more than 50% Samoans on the system and able to vote. Whether or not resources will be supplanted in time in terms of carrying out the voting booths. Now, this exercise is a whole of government. And we saw in the last general election, people had to take time off work from their various different ministries and be part of these teams. Now, that's another big undertaking. And my understanding, it took more than 2 months to pull together this group of volunteers who work within the booths. So we haven't seen this operationalized. And that could also be an obstacle in the performance of these elections. For us, it's time will tell. And whether the courts may change their decision and see a forced or by-election or maybe a change in mind. But I think in terms of building a base for the return of FMA and the promises she's bringing forth stability in what has been a very tumultuous 1 year in politics in Samoa.
And that is Salaam Dr. George Carter speaking to our ABC reporter in Samoa, Adele Fruin. Pacific Beat. Well, when Solomon Islands hosted the Pacific Games in late 2023, their team raked in a record haul of 80 medals for the country, including 12 gold. The athletes' success was put down in no small part to the impact of CINIS, the Solomon Islands National Institute of Sport, which was set up prior to the Games and based on the PNG model, which proved so successful for their team in 2015. But once the Games in Honiara were over, CINIS was plunged into a period of uncertainty. Sporting federations were barred from using it at one point, staff were concerned about job security, and no one knew where future funding for the Institute was going to come from. But now, as Richard Hewitt reports, Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele has put minds at rest by pledging financial support from government for CINIS on an annual basis.
Built by China Civil Engineering Construction Corporation, CINIS opened its doors 2 years ahead of the Pacific Games in November 2021. It was hailed as the future of sports development in Solomon Islands, and that optimism was reinforced when the nation's athletes delivered their best ever performance at the Games in 2023. However, once the event was over, some 18 months of uncertainty followed for the staff at CINIS and for the athletes they served, and there were huge doubts over future funding. But now, at last, those doubts have been put to rest by Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele, with the promise of annual funding from government that was music to the ears of Solomon Islands sporting royalty, gold medal winning weightlifter Jenly Winnie.
What he said was the CINIS programs and all the things we do for CINIS will continue running. So for me, as an elite athlete and also a coach, that's what we want to hear from the government. He's really supporting sport, and what we are looking forward to now is when the government giving funds, if it really comes to CINIS, that's a good thing, so that the programs continue as we normally do from the beginning.
Once a professional rugby league player with the Mackay Cutters in the Queensland Cup, Zan Djokovic returned to his country of heritage prior to the Pacific Games in 2023 to take up the role of performance manager at CINIS, and he says the last 18 months have been difficult.
There was a bit of uncertainty, which led to confusion and miscommunication along the lines. Definitely a lot of roadblocks, but we still had ongoing programs and events and our processes that were put into place and how we were set up. But we managed to get through it, and in the end, with a positive outcome.
As well as guaranteeing funding, the Manele government has also handed over control of the Institute to the Solomon's National Sports Council. It's a move that causes Jenly Winnie some concerns, because CINIS has still not replaced their inaugural director, Aaron Alsop, and past relations with the NSC have been fraught at times.
We're still waiting what's the next thing from NSC to us. And like, we don't want changes because all the programs are like a chain. All the departments are working together to prepare the athletes for international competition or national competition here in Solomon Islands. So the funds that are coming into Sydney, that's the most important thing.
It will be a little bit of a transition process. It's just understanding that Sinus is built for a purpose and not to really interfere with, you could say, the technical side of things with regards to the strength and conditioning and maybe the well-being team. Give us full autonomy over the decisions we make as we are the experts in high performance. And I guess with NSC being the admin side of things, help streamline the process with a lot of things with regards to procedures and whatnot. It complements what we do.
Right now, Sinus is understaffed compared to the numbers that were there for the Pacific Games. Jen Lee Winnie, for example, is the only strength and conditioning coach in the combat sports and weights division. But Zanjokovic is hopeful that optimum staffing levels can be restored under the new government deal.
We're probably not going to be as busy as we were before the Pacific Games, given that we were the host country. We're probably not going to be at that same capacity, but in saying that, we still need departments to be filled in order for us to run efficiently. With the numbers we have now, we are getting by, but there is a lot of pressure on our staff. So if we want the quality and the work output and the best results, we would need definitely a few more hands on deck.
So like, it is really difficult when our teams are coming in. We have to have good numbers to do the programs for the athletes, and it will be workload for other staff for us SNC. Example, like three teams together in a day and you continue on for the whole day. It's not right. We need more staff.
The previous Sogavare government spent big on Sinus for the Pacific Games, but once they were over, there was no obvious contingency plan. As a result, the last year and a half has seen pressure on Jen Lee Winnie and her fellow staff members who are still on the payroll increase.
This is where we develop the athletes, and to develop athletes for the future competition like the Olympic or Commonwealth Games, we have to make use of this facility. It's a history for Solomon Island, this building, but staffs are working overtime. And the important thing is you have to look also for the well-being of the staff here.
Zanjokovic says the government's funding package means Sinus will be able to deliver on a much-talked-about post-game strategy of their own and creates opportunities for expansion.
That's going to tick all the boxes with regards to why we were built and Sinus's legacy plan. It's going to enable us to be able to initiate these programs and trainings and even engagements with overseas institutes. We have a lot of programs, events, partnerships lined up, and the funding that they allocate to us comes to us directly. We shouldn't be running into any problems in the near future. So there's definitely a lot of room for growth.
And now the immediate target for Sinus is the upcoming Pacific Mini Games in Palau.
We've got a pretty good group going across. We're working off the back of our success at the Pacific Games. And Sinus Institute is definitely a big boost for the athletes and the federations here. Got to get a few things in order before we can keep going. But there's a bright future for us here at Sinus, as long as everyone else plays their part.
Well, Jen Lee Winnie will be in Palau to coach and to compete, but will we be seeing her in action at the next Pacific Games in Tahiti? She says not, but she also says age isn't a factor as she approaches her 42nd birthday next month.
This will be my fourth mini game, and I think I'll be going for the Commonwealth game, but we'll see what happens on the qualification events. So this mini game is my last mini game. 223 was my last Pacific game. 227 will be a coaching event for me.
I wonder if you might be tempted to change your mind come 2027.
If I have the strength to continue on, why not?
Well, you wouldn't bet against her competing in 2027, would you? That's Jen Lee Winnie, Solomon Islands sporting superstar and set to play a key role as a coach at Sinus for years to come, you would think. But that's the reporter there, Richard Hewitt.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Malo tau mai bongbongini. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Thubol. While women are hugely underrepresented in the marine industry's workforce across the world, making up just 29% of the workforce. In the Pacific, women often only have support roles in the industry and rarely hold technical or leadership roles. But an organisation called Daughters of the Deep is trying to change this. The not-for-profit organises education scholarships, training and job placements to help empower women in marine industries. Our reporter, Jordan Fennell, spoke to 17-year-old Esterina Thonga from Niue about how support from Daughters of the Deep has paved a pathway for marine work.
Hi, my name is Esterina Thonga, and I am on my last year of high school. and I've been with the Daughters of the Deep for about 3 years now.
First of all, Esterina, I know that you've done a number of different things through Daughters of the Deep, but I first wanted just to hear about your connection to the ocean and marine life. Why is that so special to you?
I've always felt connected. It's like a second home to me. There's something peaceful about being in the water, hearing the waves, and just seeing how everything under the surface moves in their own rhythm. I love marine life because it's so diverse and full of wonders. Every time I go out snorkeling or just watch the sea, I discover something new, whether it's a colorful fish, a coral pattern, or even just the light reflects on the water. It reminds me how alive and powerful nature is. It makes me want to learn more, protect it, and share that love with others.
2 years ago, you sort of started this journey with Daughters of the Deep. Can you tell me about how that came to be?
Okay, so the Daughters of the Deep is it's a program that empowers young women to connect with the ocean, learning new skills like diving and guiding and taking on leadership role in marine conservation. I feel like it's all about creating space for us or for girls to grow confident in the water and feel proud of who they are, both in ocean and in their communities. I first got involved through an introduction class that was held at school. I was already passionate about the ocean, so when I heard about the program designed especially for girls like me who love the sea and I wanted to protect it, I knew I had to be part of it.
And I understand that one of the first things that you were doing was learning about whale guiding. Can you tell me about what that experience was like?
My journey into whale guiding started back in 2023. And honestly, it was something I didn't expect to fall in love with as deeply as I did. I got a chance to be part of a program that involves working closely with marine guides, like workers from Niue Blue. That's when I first experienced whales up so close. And seeing them in their natural habitat, so huge, graceful and calm, just gives me this overwhelming feeling of awe and responsibility. And I knew right then I wanted to be part of that space to help guide others and seeing these creatures respectfully and to help protect them and our ocean.
Before you were learning about whale guiding, had you ever been out swimming with whales in Niue before, or was this the very first time?
No, it was actually my very first time. And yeah, I usually see whales from offshore, but this is my first time to experience it. So close. Yeah, it was a humpback whale. The moment I saw it really kissed me, I just felt like I need to protect it and protect the ocean because I want to see it more. So
you then, after you were doing that, you did go to do a paddy scuba diving experience. What was that like?
After getting taste of the ocean through snorkeling and whale guiding, I decided to take a further step with paddy. A scuba diving experience honestly just opened up a whole new world for me. The training was a mix of excitement and challenge. At first, it was a bit scary learning how to breathe underwater and manage the gear, but with time, it became second nature. Once I got comfortable, I started to enjoy the feeling of being completely surrounded by marine life, going deeper than I've ever had before. So when I joined Niue Blue and became a open water diver, it felt like a huge step forward for me. The team there really supported me and the hands-on experience helped me build confidence. And yeah, not just about diving, it's about learning to respect the ocean even more and just understanding how every little thing we do can impact the marine environment.
Now, you're a certified open water diver, and you were doing that training with Niue Blue. Niue Blue is a company that does tours, diving tours, snorkeling tours. For you, what does it mean that a tourism provider has partnered with Daughters of the Deep so that you can have this experience that you've had? Why is, I guess, that important that that's been facilitated for you?
Yes, so having Niue Blue, a key tourism provider, a partner with the Daughters of the Deep, has meant so much to me. Their support has not only allowed me to gain my diving certification, but also opened doors to experience that many people only dream of. And because of this partnership, I've had the chance to learn, dive, and explore in a way that I wouldn't have been able to without their backing. So it's more than just gaining a certification. It's about having that chance to be part of something bigger, contributing to the preservation of Niue's ocean environment and giving back to the community the sharing of the ocean's beauty with by sharing the ocean's beauty with others. So this collaboration has shaped my journey in such a meaningful way.
And what do you hope to do with this certification? Do you want to be working in tourism, like with Niue Blue and other things?
I hope to continue empowering myself and others in marine industry, like the Daughters of the Deep has done for me. I'm passionate about the oceans, and I want to use this certification not only dive and guide, but to inspire others, especially women, to step into these roles too. Tourism is such a powerful tool for education and conservation, and I'd love to share my knowledge and love for the ocean with visitors, helping them connect with marine life the way I have. But more than that, I want to be part of a movement that promotes sustainability, ensuring the beauty of Niue's ocean and wildlife is preserved for future generations.
And that's Esterina Tholam speaking there to our reporter, Jordan Fennell.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? PolyTalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on PolyTalk.
Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Nissan Bolivinaka, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, it's been exactly 25 years now since one of Fiji's darkest days. It's the 2000 Fiji coup. It started on May 19th when seven gunmen stormed the Fiji Parliament building in Suva, taking the Prime Minister and 50 parliamentarians hostage. At the time of the coup, Nirmal Singh Chima served as a political and public diplomacy specialist at the American Embassy in Suva. Mr. Chima says he had been made aware about the threat of a coup and had warned the Chaudhry government beforehand.
Well, okay, you know, here's the thing. I was the political and public affairs specialist with the American Embassy in Suva at that time. And just to give an overview, we had some intelligence, you know, there are rumblings going on that there may be an attempt to take over Mr. Chaudhry's government on Friday. So we did, on Wednesday, my ambassador and I did approach Mr. Chaudhry and told him that to defuse the situation and there might be an attempt to take over his government. So Mr. Chaudhry, I think, did not take it very seriously because of the support of the president, and he didn't realize because the economy was doing very well. I don't think he took seriously that there would be an attempt to remove his government. So we came back, you know, knowing that Mr. Chaudhry hasn't paid much attention to it. And then in the afternoon, ambassador called me again. He said, why don't you go to and talk to Krishnadath, who was a senior member of Chaudhry cabinet. So I spoke to Mr. Krishnadath as well on Wednesday. Yeah, so again, Mr. Krishnadath was trying to sort of sort things out. But then, you know, I don't think anybody in the country was sort of feeling there won't be any coup. So come Friday, myself and my political officer, we were monitoring the march. We're right in the city. And I was right in front of the march, you know, and as we approached, it was quite peaceful march. You know, when we started, there were about 50 people. But as the march went on, halfway through the city, you know, the crowd just bulged into thousands. And by the time we went to the Albert Park area, a group of people went to present the petition to Joe Brown, who was the permanent secretary for the prime minister, for the president at that time. And I think that's where Mr. Brown announced that the parliament has been taken over. And that's when the entire, all the whole hell loose broke. You know, people went berserk. They, you know, I was guided into a police van who was right in front and going towards parliament. I jumped into the police van and the whole mob was after the police van throwing stones. And we kept watching until we went to the parliament. And on the way, any cars that were parked, you know, the police were shouting, close the business along the Nafsese. So, you know, as we went up to the parliament gate, we saw armed people and, with the guns and all those stuff. And then, once the police reached the gate, the people are near the gate. Aimed their gun at the police, and then they jumped, sort of pressed the fuel, and then, you know, we went ahead. So my ambassador's car was waiting there, I got into it. And by then we could see from there at the Parliament House, fumes, the smokes blowing out of Suva, and at that time we know Suva was burning.
Wow. And so you were working with the U.S. Embassy, and you actually had a tip-off, or there was already rumors at the time that there was going to be a coup. Where did this information come from?
Well, you know, I cannot speak about it. You know, I have to respect my work at the U.S. Embassy at that time. But generally, the intelligence was that there may be an attempt to remove Mr. Chaudhary's government. And we did the right thing. We advised the government. We had advised Mr. Chaudhary. We advised the Minister for Foreign Affairs. And that's where the thing is. But the thing is this, bro. If you really look at it, now when you sit down and reflect on what happened on 2000, I don't know if there was any means or to stop this thing. Because, you know, when you really reflect now, the law enforcement agencies, the police force, the military even, you know, they seem to be incapable of protecting the government, you know, and the people who could come from Tailevu, Naita Siri, and remote areas march into the town, march up to the parliament without any restriction shows clearly that there was no will on the part of the law enforcement agencies for some reason or the other to stop this from happening. And, you know, if you could see in one of the pictures where the former police commissioner, Isikia Savua, is standing over the wrecks and you hardly see any police officers around. So, you know, and when the arms reach there has been in the parliament, obviously there has been some support from the military as well. How can the arms be moved from the military to the parliamentary ground?
Yeah.
So, you know, the people moved into the parliament and all those stuff without unrestricted access to parliament, you know, from far areas, remote areas, why there was no roadblock. So I think there was some support from the law enforcement agencies towards this cause of overthrowing Chaudhary government. I think the fear was that people living, especially people, Indo-Fijian people living in remote areas like Muaniveni and other remote areas, they were really subjected to a lot of abuse.
How widespread? Could you give a specific example?
Okay, after the event, we went to Muaniveni area, you know, that was in Baulevu area. That was one of the places that was very badly affected, or people were sort of beaten up there. That's where things were bad, and, you know, we went and met the people around the place, you know. One place we saw only the grandparents were around, you know, they were crying, and we asked them, where are the family? They said, they have moved to west. They were the Girmit Center in Latuka. So there was eyewitnesses who were telling us hell they went through, you know. They never expected this to happen, because some of the people who committed these things were their friends. They sat down together, they ate together, they lived in the settlement, and you know, they were taken aback with same people standing up and beating them up.
Does current day Fiji still feel the impacts of the past?
I think so, because, you know, more than two decades later, we have started this reconciliation process. Most of the people are not around anymore, they have passed on. So I really don't know what the reconciliation process will bring in when the people who might have been affected, or my people who are accused, are no longer to justify themselves. But it has an impact. It has a very frightening impact. And let's pray we never have to revisit this situation.
And now Mary Chapman, who was the Secretary to Parliament at the time, says she was in New Zealand when Parliament was stormed, but quickly returned to Fiji to assist authorities in getting food to the hostages.
My main priority at that time was that the members who were kept in the chambers were looked after. They were fed, and I arranged this with the caterers. So I operated from there in Midway and looking after the members who were outside, you know, writing to them, keeping their morale up, when the arrangement was made that the members would be released. I was told that I could go into parliament. And that was the thing that's in my mind, me and my staff going to parliament, the permanent secretary of finance and the secretary of public service commission at that time, and the auditor general, of course, and the ministry of information photographers. If we could all meet in parliament to see the damage that was done. Unfortunately, none of these gentlemen, permanent secretary of finance, permanent secretary of public service commission, and the auditor general, they didn't turn up, except for the ministry of information director, who came with his team, the staff, and we took photos of the damage that was done. They didn't show this in the TV, all the clips of this what was taken, because according to the Minister of Information, people that saw the what was done in Parliament, the damage, the actual damage, my office was damaged. Oh gosh! But you know, all this footage would be in our archives in the Ministry of Information, which was never allowed to be released.
When you said damage, like what kind of damage?
You know, I had a well-contained office with a bathroom, and I had my stuff there because I had to be on 24 hours. You know, I could be on duty 24 hours. You know, functions to attend to, this and that. So I live in Nosori, which is, you know, the airport, Nosori Airport. And then it would be hard for me to run here and go back to the office. So I had a lot of my stuff there, but I'm talking about structural damage, you know, like cows hanging from the, dripping from the place, what you call the Mbure, down the, where the kitchen, the people that were killing cows, delivering cows and dalo and all, to feed the people who are part of the coup makers, you know. And they will kill the bullocks or cows hanging from, so the blood would be dripping, and they'll shove it in the fridge, which is not supposed to look after meat for a long time. They should have been a freezer. But everything was, all the fridge, each of the officers of the parliament, they were all damaged, and we had to get rid of all these things. If somebody is brave enough to get the clip from Ministry of Information archives, which was the Ministry of Information, actual photographs of that particular day when we went in, we took all the photos down, but it was not allowed to be shown to the public. Wow. By the Minister of Information at that time, because Wow. he thought, in his deliberate judgment, that it would cause more anger in the public.
And that was Mary Chapman, former secretary to Fiji's parliament. Now, over the past week, photos of Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape playing basketball have been making waves on PNG social media. In one playful caption, the Prime Minister is tagged as LeBron James Marape, an ode to NBA superstar LeBron James. The photos were taken at the launching of a Golden Oldies competition, a new campaign to get retired people in their 40s, 50s and 60s to exercise and live healthy. Basketball PNG President David Peter says the tournament comes as the Federation picked up 1.3 million kina from Coolmore Mineral Holdings Limited to take part in four international events, including the Mini Pacific Games and the Pacific Games.
Basically, getting the older people involved in basketball, and the age category we're looking at is people over age 45 years above. So that's the group that actually are going to participate in this event. But some are beyond 45, 50, 60, and even 70. So it's more or less anybody from above 45 years of age. So this is the idea with the Prime Minister actually mentioned to the Federation that we need to involve the older people to participate in a competition like this, so they can stay healthy and they participate in this sport in basketball, and they can work on improving on their health. The theme or the main message for the competition is health is wealth. So yesterday the Prime Minister asked those above, 45 years of age to participate in this competition. A lot of times people just sit in their homes or in their workplaces and don't worry about their health a lot. But I think this is one of the initiatives that is trying to promote healthy living, because when you have a healthy community or healthy individuals, you have healthy economy where you have healthy people contributing towards the growth and development of the nation.
Now, just tell us about the competition itself. How long will this competition be running for? Because we're only a few months away from the country's 50th anniversary.
Yeah, so we're just at the initial stages of the competition. So we did our exhibition match last night, but from the records we have so far, we've got about 38 teams that have indicated to participate. So now we will have to do up the draws and we'll have to do the schedules for these teams to play this competition twice or once in a month. So it's in a week. So I talked with the Prime Minister about how we're going to schedule this together with his busy schedule and all the other schedules. And it's pretty much going to come down to how many teams that will have shown the interest by the end of the week. And we should be able to get a confirmed number of teams that are going to participate. And based on that, we will be able to do the schedule.
Is this competition also incorporated towards the country's 50th jubilee?
We're going to be playing this competition twice every week. That's the initial indications, up till the midweek of September. So that's going to lead directly into the independence. So I can't really say much about how that's going to be incorporated into the celebration of the event. But all I know is that at this stage is that the Prime Minister won this event to actually lead into the independence celebration for the country.
Any possibility you think the Prime Minister might get onto the basketball courts?
Well, anything is possible. Yeah, but he's so excited and he's shown a lot of passion, because all of yesterday he spent his time talking about basketball with all his staff and with all his advisors, and then they called me from time to time and gave me their team list and when they should be wearing what color uniforms and that sort of thing. So the Prime Minister is really excited about participating in this event. It's first of its kind. How many times have we seen the Prime Minister, a sitting Prime Minister for the country, coming to play any sport? I mean, they probably play golf and the other stuff, but other games, but especially a competition that involves, for people to running up and down the court doing a bit of, involves a lot of, work. You don't normally see the Prime Minister get involved, but here is the, leader of the country getting involved in basketball. So that sends a very strong message to everyone that, their health is very important, as well as in sport we can contribute towards the growth and development of the country.
Can you tell us what other events there are also lined up for Basketball PNG for the remainder of this year? I know you said earlier you're looking at four different competitions. Can you tell us what these competitions are? Because we have the mini games and the Pacific Games are still ahead.
Actually, at our national stadium, and the people that are downstairs training for the Mini Pacific Games coming up in July. We will be sending an under 23 3x3 team to participate in Palau in the first week of July. And then we'll have the 5x5 senior men and women going to Solomon Islands to participate in the Malaysian Cup. And then we will have the under 17s going to Samoa to participate in the Oceania under 17 competition. So we got quite a handful of competition lined up this year. Probably that's the first time we're doing four competitions in a year. Just hoping that the support that we need comes through from our stakeholders and our teams, our players and team is actually preparing and getting ready for these competitions. Because the Palau game and the Palau competition and the Samoa competitions are requirements for entering into the World Cup for us.
And that was BPNG President David Peter talking to reporter Godwin Ecking. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Now remember, you can find our top stories on our website by typing Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine. But join us again tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. But you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next on ABC Radio Australia, though, is your news. And coming up after that, it is the guys on Nisha Daily. So until next time, otoa o whātou. You've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.